Okay, cool. So we're now recording. So, Dr. Val Carson, thank you for joining me
Thanks for
on
having me.
BC Panacea Podcast number two. So, do you want to start just by giving people a little bit of an idea of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm a pretty newly assistant professor at the University of Alberta, and my research right now is all in physical activity, sedentary behavior in young children.
And so first question then, I guess, how did you sort of get into research in the first place? Like, did you do a lot of research in undergrad, or were you really passionate about a certain issue that kind of brought you in? Like, how did you get into the research enterprise?
Yeah, so when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I was planning on being a phys ed teacher.
Oh,
So
really?
I was doing like a combined degree with kinesiology and education and wanted to be a high school phys ed teacher and a basketball coach.
Oh, that's very old school, kid.
Yeah, and then in my last, I think my second last year, I started getting involved with some research with one of my professors and really enjoyed it. And I thought that going on into graduate school and becoming a professor could allow me to teach and to do research at the same time. So it seemed like a good combo of two things that I enjoyed doing.
That's cool. That's actually sort of in high school, I thought about going not into being a phys ed teacher but teaching, and I sort of also like that about doing both. So, but now are you doing much teaching now, or you're in a mainly research position, right?
I have teaching release until the fall. So, and then once in the fall, I'll have two classes, and the following year, I'll start into three. And
Oh, okay. Oh,
that's,
so they're easing you in. Oh, that's nice.
yeah, it's very nice.
That's really nice. And so then your undergrad research, was that sort of sport based? Were you immediately attracted to the health stuff, or were you more into sport stuff since you were, varsity athlete, sort of, more that into things back then?
The study that I was helping out with, it was just like a stair climbing study, so when I was just collecting data. So I guess it was a bit more health related. But then when I was deciding that I wanted to apply to some master degree programs, I was speaking to one of my teachers, supervising teachers at one of the placements that I was at, and he had done his master's degree, and he was just telling me that he thought childhood obesity was kind of an important area right now, and it's something that he's really noticed in his time being a phys ed teacher, and that kind of sparked my interest. And so when I was looking for programs, I was specifically looking for people who did research in childhood obesity.
Oh, cool. And so then, just because I'm curious, so are you actually qualified to teach? Like, could you like go into a school and teach things too, like as a teacher?
I did. I
Oh, yeah,
got
that.
my degree. I did some substitute teaching before I started my master's degree.
Really? Good for you. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think like some people ask, was that kind of, do you feel it was a waste to have spent 5 years kind of getting your education degree? But I think now teaching at the university level, it's very helpful to have that background and that experience.
Yeah, well, and especially, I mean, most people that have your sort of research CV are people that they don't often have that much focus or interest in teaching. So the fact that you have both is actually really cool. And so then saying you went to your master's at U of A with John Spence, and so that was focusing on childhood obesity specifically.
Yeah, so I guess John was a good fit going into a master's because so his research is a lot on the built environment, and so my minor with my undergraduate degree was geography, so it
Oh.
was a good fit in terms of kind of my major and my minor that he had. And I had just gotten a lot of advice that U of A, like I didn't really know much about John, and I didn't know much about grad school in general, but I had a lot of people tell me that U of A was a good place to be. So that was kind of, I more went there just because I heard it was a good graduate school. So
Right.
yeah, and I left out that John was a great supervisor and does some great work in that area.
Yeah, you lucked into a good person. It's funny because I did one with Atif. Well, like you said, you saw the one with Atif a few weeks ago, and it's funny that he sort of did the same thing, and just fell into Will and Ian, and like you both been very lucky to fall into some really, really good people.
Yeah, definitely.
And so then, so was your master's thesis on like built environments and childhood obesity stuff?
Yeah, so John, a major model that John uses is the ecological model. So the idea that behaviors can be influenced by multiple levels. And so his research focuses a lot on kind of the more distal levels of looking at policy and the environment. And so my master's work was looking at some correlates of children's physical activity and sedentary behavior, but it was focusing more on those kind of higher levels. So I was looking at seasonality, and I was looking at kind of some neighborhood factors in relation to sedentary behavior.
And so did you, I'm curious, because that sort of stuff that I'm moving into now with my postdoc is looking at sedentary behavior and the built environment. So did you find, did it matter, the built environment for
yeah, my last study of my master's degree was looking at neighborhood social economic status and its influence on screen time in a cohort of children ages 4 to 6, and it was associated, a strong predictor of screen time. So I guess the idea that if children, if they're in a good neighborhood where they can get outside and do things versus if they're not in such a great neighborhood, they're more likely to be inside, and then when you're inside, you're more likely to be on a screen.
That's cool. Now, did you tease out at all, like, neighborhood versus, like, family-level SES? Like,
yes.
So it wasn't just a proxy then for, like, the family being low-income or something?
Yeah, it was adjusted for individual SES as well, but I'm sure there's kind of a mixture of both within that measure.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I assumed you would have adjusted for that, but I was curious. That's cool.
Yeah.
And so then you moved from there to do a PhD at Queen's.
Yes.
And what your specific focus there was, again, physical activity and sedentary time in kids?
Yes, yeah, so my PhD research was all on sedentary behavior and children and youth. And so my last study of my master's degree on sedentary behavior, I didn't know a whole lot about sedentary behavior until I started that last study and started reading a lot of literature, and I just found it really interesting that a child could be active and meeting the physical activity guidelines and then still be engaging in lots of sedentary behavior. And at that time, it was just starting to come out that essentially you could still have negative health impacts by being very sedentary. So that was really interesting to me, and there wasn't a lot of work in that area. So I thought that that might be a good choice of a topic to kind of tackle for my PhD.
Yeah, and so what's your take then on, you know, because depending on whose research you follow, you know, like some stuff, especially TV time, seems really important, but then, you know, some of Al Becklin's stuff suggests that directly measured sedentary time in kids doesn't always turn out, and even some of your stuff. So what do you think's going on there? That screen time seems so important, and, you know, directly measured sedentary time seems less.
Yeah, so I think, well, for the most part, we see relationships in adults with the sedentary time and the health implications. So I think a part of it is perhaps just the exposure, that children haven't been exposed as much to the sedentary behavior. They haven't developed a lot of those risk factors that adults have developed. We use a lot of, you know, these cardiometabolic risk factors that aren't, you know, maybe is relevant for children and youth. And so maybe we need to think of what other health outcomes that we should be focusing on in that age group.
Do you have any suggestions for that? For like, cause I agree, like, kids are just so freaking healthy that nothing, do you have any ideas for like other health things to look at?
Yeah. Well, a study that I just got funding for right now is looking at more cognitive health outcomes. In young, really young children. So I guess the idea that, and that's a really important, I think, aspect for parents as well. So telling a parent that their child shouldn't watch television is meeting the guidelines because they might get, you know, type 2 diabetes or they might be obese. It's not really relevant, but if it relates to kind of their child being successful in school and transitioning into school, that we've found in focus groups, that's a really important aspect.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. That's very interesting. And actually there was a review, I'm not sure if you saw it, just came out, people arguing that there might not only be sort of behavioral links between sedentary time and you know, mental health, but also sort of physiological changes that being exposed to high levels of insulin and glucose could actually have some sort of effect on the brain.
Right.
Which is cool. I'm planning to do I'm hoping to get the author of that to do a guest post soon.
Oh, cool.
It's kind of a cool topic, but
and I think the measurement too. So the most of the work has been done with accelerometers, and a little bit of work's now starting to come up with more like active PALs and things like that. So whether we're accurately capturing sitting with the accelerometer or whether there's a kind of a lot of noise going on there, and maybe if the relationships aren't quite as strong in children, then maybe that noise is kind of what's preventing us from seeing any associations.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially because with the interventions, like, it seems strange how consistent it is, you know, with David Dunstan's intervention, and now there have been three or four others that, you know, if adults sit for like 8 hours, it's like very measurable. And then, you know, my thesis stuff and Susan Sisson's is just finding not a whole lot.
Right.
So yeah, which is good. I mean, it's,
yeah,
in some ways it's good, but
yeah,
it's, yeah, it's strange.
Yeah. And I think it's still, you can still make the argument for wanting to target sedentary behavior in children if those behaviors are going to track over time. So
yeah, no, I totally agree. And now, what do you think about the message? This came up, I'm sure this probably has come up for you a lot, and it came up a lot in my thesis defense of, okay, sedentary time, sure, it's bad, but if we get these kids active for 45 minutes a day, who cares what they do the rest of the day? Because the activity is what matters, and if they're out there and they're exercising vigorously, nothing else matters. So
mm-hmm.
where do you come down in terms of what matters, and in terms of like public health, what should we be focusing on?
Yeah, and I think that's an important part of sedentary behavior research, is not to say that physical activity doesn't matter. I think it's the idea that it's a combination of the two. So I think obviously physical activity is going to give you the biggest bang for your buck, but there's only so much physical activity that we can do in a day. So if we can, you know, increase physical activity at the same time, increasing like moderate to vigorous activity, and then at the same time reducing sedentary behavior and maybe getting some more light activity, I think it's a combination of the two behaviors. And I think at the end of the day, there's just so many children and youth who aren't getting that vigorous physical activity. So to turn around
right.
and say, okay, now you need to get 45 minutes of vigorous physical activity when you've been getting zero, I don't think that's a real, like, accurate or realistic thing. So I think
right.
even maybe reducing sedentary behavior and getting more light activity could almost be bridging to getting them to do more moderate to vigorous.
Yeah, I like to think of light activity as like the gateway drug to exercise. Of, you know, you can do that, then it's, you know, build the self-efficacy and sort of, you know, move towards that.
Right. Yeah. No,
yeah. So, now, so then sort of over your, you know, I guess it's not a super long research career, but like 6 or 8 years, whatever it's been, sort of what's, do you have any papers that like you're especially like really like proud of?
Yeah, well, I guess the one of the papers in my PhD that, I know you've seen before with the NHANES data, and we're looking at bolts and brakes. That was a paper I was really excited about, just because there hadn't been, any work at the time done on kind of patterns of sedentary behavior in children and youth. So
yeah.
That was kind of an exciting study for me. And then during my PhD, I collected data in about 800 children and their parents, ages 0 to 5. And
wow.
Yeah, it was a big study, but we... it was mostly focusing on screen time. So instead of, I found most research, they collect physical activity data and they'll also collect some screen time data, but then most of the correlates or the determinants that they're looking at are focused on physical activity. And so because we have the screen time data, then they'll also, we'll see if some of these correlates are associated with screen time. But for our study, we want to focus specifically on correlates that are specific to screen time. And we were able to predict a lot of the variance in children's screen time when we were using kind of measures specific to screen time. And then this work's kind of really led to some of the work that I'm doing now in my current position. So that work I'm pretty passionate about as well.
Yeah, and so what were the big correlates there? Like, what were the really important ones?
The strongest ones were actually parental cognitions is the kind of umbrella term we use. So parents' confidence to say no to their child in engaging in screen time, attitudes towards screen time, barriers to reducing their children's screen time, and what they thought was normal or typical for their child to engage in screen time. So a lot had to do, and this was, you know, again, 0 to 5 year olds, where they don't have obviously a lot of autonomy from their parents that
right.
their children and adolescents would have. So it seemed like their parents played a pretty big role in predicting their behavior
yeah.
around screen time.
That's cool, and that's sort of a nice message that, like, parents can have an impact. Like, I remember seeing there's a a paper from Susan Sisson from a few years ago, because she was my external on my thesis, so I read all of her papers. And one of hers, I remember the take-home message was like, the one thing that parents can do is have rules about screen time, and that was strongly associated with the amount of screen time. So now whenever I do talks, I sort of tell people, like, you know, if you do one thing, just make rules about screen time.
Yeah.
And so it seems like that sort of fits then with your findings from that, I guess.
Yeah, and actually I appreciate your take on it in a positive manner, because in my defense and in presentations that I've done, I think you have to be very careful about how you present that information, because some parents take it offensively that you're blaming parents for children's behavior. But I think that's a nice spin on how to
Oh, good.
That one.
Yeah, have you had that in interviews? Because I've had some interviews start off with, like, so what are parents doing wrong and how should they change? Or, like trying to get you to say that it's all parents' fault.
Yeah, so I always try to make sure that it doesn't come across that I'm blaming parents for everything. So.
No, the mental image I got when that happened was the old TV show Lost in Space, when the robot would just go, danger, danger. That's like the image that popped up in my head. I was like, no.
Yeah.
No, do not quote me on anything related to that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's funny, your other study that you're proud of is one that, I think I've told you this before, that was like one of my thesis work projects. And then it was like the week after I proposed that, I was like, oh, and I'm not doing that. It was between submitting my proposal and actually doing the oral defense of my proposal.
Yeah.
So the timing was good, because if you had published that like a year later, it would have really, really screwed me over. And that is a cool paper. Like, I've cited that paper a bunch of times. And it was, because like you said, there were like the two papers by Jen Healy and Adult showing that breaks were important. And then yours came out showing that, like, really not a whole lot going on in kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a very cool study.
Yeah, and I mean, you still are able to get some studies on that as well, because I think there's still a lot more work to be done in that area. So I think the more work we can do and kind of the better we can tease out these relationships, the stronger evidence that we'll have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and we just did one in kids with a family history of obesity and saw that breaks. Well, yeah, you know that one, obviously.
Yeah.
It seemed like it did matter. So I'm still curious to see if anyone else has similar populations, to see if we just got the 1 out of 20 studies that saw the significant association where there is none, or if it turns out that those kids with a bit higher risk do.
Right.
It would kind of make sense.
It does make sense, definitely.
Yeah, but yeah. So looking back then, sort of at research in general, is there anything, or not research, but your sort of grad school training and undergrad and all of it, is there anything that you would do differently or give general advice for students who, you know, want to sort of go through and do a PhD and get an academic position?
Yeah, I don't think I would do anything differently. I think some of the things that I kind of took away from my training is to do kind of work that you're passionate about. So when I'm talking with graduate students now about working with me, that's something that kind of a philosophy that I have, that to spend on average 2 years for a master's degree, or on average 4 years for a PhD, to be doing something that you're not really passionate about or that you don't enjoy, I don't think is a good scenario.
Yeah.
So I think trying to find, I guess, a supervisor that's doing work that you're interested in and passionate about, and not just kind of settling for just to get a degree sort of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is it weird now being a prof in the same school where you did a master's?
It felt a bit weird at first, but now it's starting to feel more normal. So.
Well, that's good, because you've been there like six. It's still not that long, I guess, is it? I was thinking you've been there a year, but it's not that long.
Yeah, I'll be a year at the end of March.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. It's that long ago since you were at Halo. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That makes me feel even worse that that I'm still trying to get papers out.
And I think something that I did a lot during my training is I kind of got involved in all sorts of different things. And so if there's different projects going on, if, you know, just networking with someone who has data sitting around that they'd like to get out, but they don't have the time. So just trying to get involved as many different projects as I can to kind of get a broad skill set and broad experience and make connections that hopefully will carry through it into my current position now. So I just tried to get involved in anything and everything, but obviously still keeping the work that I need to get done as a priority.
Right, that's the fine line, right? Is like getting involved as much as possible, but without like doing an 8-year PhD at the same time.
Yeah, and I think something that I look back on, you know, the PhD is a really great time that you have to read and to, you know, you want to learn a different statistical technique that you can take the time to read about that and to learn new stuff, because now it's just like you have so many roles and responsibilities that some of that time is just, you just don't have. So to have the time to learn things and to read things, and I think to take advantage of that time.
It's depressing to think that as a prof, you have less time than you do as a grad student. Because as a grad student, you feel so friggin' busy all the time.
Yeah.
But I've heard that from everyone, like, oh, enjoy this time because it's relaxing and quiet.
Yeah. I think you just have more kind of roles that you have to fill that eats away some of your time.
Right, of course. And so I guess last question then, sort of, well, no, I guess I got two other questions. So one is, how did your research sort of evolve over time? And was it sort of because your interest changed, or was it because of, you know, just who you were working with? Or did your research evolve over time, I guess?
Yeah, well, I guess it's all kind of, for me, it was really linked. So my last study and my master's degree kind of fed into my PhD, and then kind of the main study that I collected data on in my PhD kind of led into the work that I'm doing now. So I think all my work still falls under kind of this umbrella of physical activity and sedentary behavior and health in children, but I've been able to kind of focus on different things that have kind of sparked my interest, or that I felt like there's kind of a gap in the literature.
And so do you put the sedentary behavior research into practice? Like I know when you were working with us that you had your tray so you could work standing up. Like, do you do a lot of things to try and reduce your sedentary time?
Yeah, I'm standing right now at my stand-up desk at home. And yeah,
fair
I actually
enough.
Just got a, I upgraded my stand-up desk at work. I got one of the Ergotron
Ooh.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah,
no, I think I like to practice what I preach. I think you obviously can't stand, like, people see my desk and they're like, oh my God, you stand all day. I'm like, well, no, it's, you know, you sit and stand, you take breaks. And I do find that I'm more productive. Like when I sit for a long time, sometimes I get kind of sleepy and restless. And so I find taking kind of breaks and working while I'm standing actually improves my productivity.
Yeah, no, I'm doing a lot of sort of just tedious data analysis stuff right now, the sort of stuff that you just sort of are over the computer doing stuff for a long time. And I don't have a standing setup right now. And I sort of noticed how much I was fidgeting. Like I was really moving a lot.
Yeah.
And whereas right now I'm actually on my bike desk. And
okay.
So I'm pedaling while we talk.
Nice.
And it is, yeah, I do find it's like, it's soothing in some ways, especially when you're doing sort of something boring. It's nice to be able to move a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think too much standing and too much sitting, both extremes are probably not that great for you. So trying to find a place in the middle.
No, I agree. Yeah, because my wife Dawn is a teacher and she teaches little kids. So she's always like, you know, like, I don't need to stand more. Because, you know, she comes home and she's exhausted from being on her feet
exactly.
All
day. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then, last question then, would you say, is there any, like, big take-home message from your research? Like, if you had to, like, summarize, like, your research in one or two sentences, what would you say?
I guess I would kind of focus on the work that I'm doing right now, and that's the idea that wanting kind of primary prevention, so wanting to give young children kind of positive physical activity experiences and develop their motor skills and develop good habits around screen time, and that hopefully those developing those good habits early on and fostering those good habits early on will kind of track through, so it'll promote kind of healthy active living throughout their life. And so that's really kind of the main focus of my research right now.
Cool. And so are you doing motor skill stuff? Just out of curiosity.
A little bit. Starting to get into the motor skills. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Mark and I and Megan Lloyd and Emily Bremer just published like a 20-year follow-up of motor skills from kids in grade 1 up to when they were 26.
Oh, wow.
The problem is that we had 100 kids at baseline and only 17 at the final follow-up.
Yeah.
And so it was the reviewers were very generous in terms of their comments, like, this is the best thing we have right now.
Yeah.
But still, it's not ideal. So it was published, but I've got a blog post that's teed up, sort of like, this is interesting, but hypothesis generating rather than hypothesis testing, you know.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a long follow-up for sure.
It was a long follow-up, yeah. And so that's why, like, it's still the best that's out there. And we found that motor skills in grade one were associated with higher levels of physical activity at age 26. So wow. Kind of what you'd expect.
Yeah, I'll have to get that study from you. That'll be a good reference for me.
Yeah, well, and so I was going to say, so, like, what you need to do is, like, start, you know, the best time to start a 20-year study was 20 years ago. Like, yeah. The second best time is now.
Yeah.
And especially now that we have objective measures, because obviously in 1991 they didn't have those.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of promise there for, you know, giving kids those skills early on, and then it removes a lot of barriers later on if they do want to be more active.
Right, and yeah, and when we just did some focus group with some parents of young children and around the sedentary behavior guidelines, and that's what a lot of parents told us. They're like, well, if we would have known this information before, like even when we were, you know, pregnant and seeing the pediatrician, that once these habits have already formed, like to try and change them even in a 3-year-old is really challenging. So, I think that's definitely what I'm focusing on right now.